Hortense Damon Clues, Reel 11. Hortense, you were telling me about these medical experiments and how, when they occurred, you had no idea what had happened to you, really, and how later on this was discovered.
That's correct. I did ask what this was, and of course, at the time, I was only a month and a half away from my 18th birthday. But it was the first time that I'd been sort of, I don't know what to say, by doctors.
Examined
or whatever it was. Later on, many years later on, after a lot of research and knowledge that came out after the war, years after, by some very specialised people here, we found out that they had sterilised me. But they haven't obviously done their job right, so they said, because it just escaped my mind which year it was. Either 61, 62, 62 I think. It was a book came out. One of the doctors that two of them got life imprisonment. And they made a pact amongst themselves that if any of them die, whoever dies first, the one that's left over will make it public. So more or less, it was all guesswork of the experience that I'd been told before, and question marks, an unbelievable reaction. No, it wasn't possible until which happened and this book was published. And I received this book, and I've still got it at home. Quite honestly, I don't understand much about it because it's so complicated and it's only a medical person. But there were a couple of incidents that I can relate to, you see. Nevertheless, then it was found out that the one that I did recognize as one that took part in this experiment thing, was the first one, and he had the order from Himmler to do the research on the sterilization. He also made a statement that letters that were found, and somebody else questioned him and asked him, what supposedly they will find out? What did he even find out? They will find out when they're older. That was when he was doing the sterilization on very young children, gypsy children, and so forth. So, all that, it was very much, if you didn't know, but I was so fortunate that again, my guardian angel, 2 days afterwards, the injection they'd given me was apparently an injection that I developed gangrene. Now, I didn't know all the layout from the camp because I really hadn't moved into a paddock yet. I was still on the front door, shall I say. It was painful, but then I suppose later on, you don't think about it and you think, that this must be what the examinations are. This was very difficult to talk about. I didn't talk about it at all. Because for many years I felt a real freak deep down. And I was put that question once when the book was written, and there was no hesitation at all. If I would have known what I knew years later, I would never have got married. Never. Because I would never have imposed that responsibility on any man. Now, luckily, I was very lucky that I had a very good husband. And, of course, I wouldn't have had my children married. That even Victor Braque, who did the experiment, didn't know how long this was going to last, you see. And it also came out, one can say, well, why were you picked? Well, that was ratified, you call it, justified. By saying a letter that Hitler sent to Himmler. And in there it says, all those that are the young ones that are in good health and that are condemned to death, and they have to do something to pay. Instead of being exterminated right from if they are in good health, they can be used in experiments. Or, in other words, they can work till the death, you see. So that, all that, but it took all years to come out. And then we all went to a barrack. Now, these were huge barracks. And don't ask me how long they were, but they were very big. And up to then, you see, like I described, the camp was very quiet because you saw nobody outside. You didn't hear anything. You sort of were away on the front, except in the morning when all the chaos was going on about the beating and wanting another, and you were all standing on a bell and all that. But then the other incidents that went on continuously day and night, somehow you didn't hear on the front door, shall I call it that? Or you were not allowed to walk down there either, because the commandanteur was there, the gas chamber, the crematorium was there, the punishment block was there. You were never allowed to come anywhere near that building. I was put in block 7, which was supposed to be a quarantine block, and it was a block where all the bathrooms and at the time some of the friends, there must have been all those that came on that train, and some of the Dutch, and we were all put in quarantine. When we arrived in that block, it was like a madhouse. You couldn't believe what you saw. You couldn't believe the noise. You couldn't believe that anybody looked so ugly and so dirty and so frightened. You thought they were all very mental cases that were absolutely... I didn't realize that till that they were normal people behind all that facade, that they were normal. And when I saw my face 3 months afterwards in a bit of a mirror, I discovered that I had become equal to them. You see, the people, I was so frightened, and I said, don't you dare touch me, and where was I? And with being very much on my own, this was the sort of the only place where, for the first time, I'd been thrown into this mental institution, shall I call it? I know it isn't correct to say that, but and people that I've known that because I always held myself separate, because I was frightened of somebody or letting something with him, somebody come denounce it for extra food or something. It went, the mistrust was all the time there. And it wasn't unfounded either. Because they give you away for a piece of bread. So, it was continuous with you. And I remember the second day I felt very ill. And I'd been a very strong girl. I couldn't understand what was the matter with me. And there were the older women from my town who were in prison with me, and who knew the whole family, and who I discovered one or two things, and I was just a snagger here or there. But they were talking. And I remember going over to them and saying I wasn't very well. You see, I suppose crying for help. And one of them said they used to have a public house where their conversations with the prisoner was, well, they literally told me that their conversation wasn't through little girls' ears. See? And apparently I collapsed at that moment. And then the next thing I remember was waking up, well, partially waking up, but I can remember somebody said, just standing level with my mom. Well, I had managed to put me and hide me on the very top. And that's as far, if you lay down flat, and you did that, that's when you touched the roof of the barrack. So, when you were in one of, see, even those are skeletons, they must have had some strength, because I couldn't do it now. If you were up there, you had to climb up there like a monkey. And then you had to roll. Roll in. And roll out. It was damn high. But how'd you got me up there? Because they hid me up there. And apparently I'd been quite a few days unconscious. Completely unconscious. And then I remember now. She may have been before, but it was a Polish doctor, prisoner. And here and there I can remember conversation that went on between us at the very left again. I could hear her say, the language, the normal language was German, you see, to one of the nurses. Political prisoner from Belgium, because each country who had their doctors and their nurses, they were angels of mercy, and they looked after their own country, you know. They didn't look after others, if they could, but they all stuck to their own country, and they really took me under their wing, because I think they knew quite a bit about me. Again, the news had leaked through from the paper, somebody that was working in, even in the camp. They had their spies in there. And when your papers followed you, because they knew I was in the partisans, you must have known I was in the partisans. I was to find that out later on. And I could hear them say, oh, she must get out of here. She can't stay here, we can't. Either another person. In any case. Then the next thing I remember was Claire Rumbum, she's dead now. She was a great mother to me. and another girl, they carried me on a stretcher and took me to what they called the Riviera. But I haven't heard that word. I heard that word later on, which was a great big joke, because all I connected to the Riviera with was the France Riviera, you see, holidays. Even in German I couldn't understand why they called it the Riviera. And once you were in there, it was a hospital, a contagious hospital. We found that on these papers in here, it's a very good expression, and they say, in the chamber of death, because very few people, you went in there and then they came out. And I remember Claire shouting at me, that this thing shouting, "Don't you dare let me down," calling you all sorts of names, "don't you be a coward," and all that. You know, when I think she must have known a bit about me, she was really aggravating me with these accusations, you see, to pull myself together and stand up. I also remember the other side, a prisoner, a Czechoslovakian prisoner, who was a doctor. And I also remember her reaction. And when I met her just last year, I asked her what she was doing there in the seat of the historian thing from Ravensbrück. And she says, "I don't remember you." I said, "I remember you." I said, "Who did you save in the camp?" I said, "Were you on the German side?" I told her to go away. But they haven't finished with me yet, because I shall demand eventually to know what she is doing on the committee. She got no right to be on that committee because I can witness against her.
What did she do? What did you see?
She was a brutal woman. She was a very brutal woman. And apparently I found out she did study after the war to become a doctor. Probably I had experiments that she experimented in the camp. She became a doctor. But she was only just a beginning nurse. And she made it out, she was called doctor in the camp, but apparently I was told now that she was, no way was she a doctor in the camp. But she was a prisoner. You see, it's a forever revolving situation, and it depends who these people meet and who they talk to, and they've been pushed in years ago. When the television first came out, and I used to look at some programs, and I used to hear some conversation. And of course, when there was something that I knew about, I mean, straight away registered. And then I couldn't believe my ears sometimes. And I used to think, why do they think they're the only survivors? How dare they stand up and say that on the television? They wrote books, they became well known. Some of the things, of course it was true, of course they were there, of course they experienced the same as anybody else. Some people experienced a bit more. But all of a sudden to make themselves into martyrs, which was not so. And there is always somebody else that's still alive that knows what went on. And I don't forget that either. In any case, I was taken in there, and she said there was no room for me. And I didn't know any medical terms. And this is a word that, as I said before, I must have had a very photographic memory. I wish I would have taken use of it when I was younger and improved my education a little bit. These words, you see, this medical word, which I didn't know. Yet I knew about when you had German readers, I knew that word, I knew that. I knew tonsillitis and all that sort of stuff. But the worst 30 words were new to me. And they stayed engraved. And I didn't know quite how they could spell it. And I came back from Germany and I didn't have. But continuously I was searching in books. Whenever anybody had a book without them knowing, I used to go through the medical books and I found these words.
What were they?
Well, one, this shepherd's rod, she's got the barriol, which is smallpox, you see, which I found out later on in an exhibition on a fairground. It did look very similar to my legs, but of course, it was said that I got gangrene. But when I found out that barriol, and I went over this. It was like Madame Tussauds, that was showing all these venereal that was just after the war, when the troops were still in there, and of course I was over 18, so before I wouldn't have been allowed in there because you had to show your passport. And of course I was determined, for the first time in my life, I was determined to go inside. And of course I had a shock on my eye, because there was my leg. There was my leg, that I can't remember. You see? And I came back, and from the very first day I came back, I met my husband. And because he had already made friends with my father. And my brother. And of course, unfortunately, I'm going back now to that instance. My leg was a monstrosity.
And that was through gangrene, was it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You could see the bone. And even though there was thin layers of this thin layer of skin on it, that you could see the bone. And when I returned to that, that was like that, you see. And my eldest sister's brother-in-law, who was a surgeon, well-known surgeon. And he, of course, was the one that was the first time straight away to take us in hand. Because the man didn't even know. I mean, he saw things that he hadn't seen before. And he always clear. Not only he couldn't find that, but he couldn't find out anything. In any case, he told me, he says, you never find a boyfriend, you won't. He says, I do plastic surgery. He got the qualifications. Things that you can't get now. We've got three or four different in the medical thing at one time, which they could go in for, but now you can only go for a certain sphere. And he did. He operated and I watched it. I said, you can't touch my leg unless I sit up and watch it. And I watched through the whole operation. You know, everybody in the family promised they were going to help him, because it put the expense down, you see. He was going to do it at home, where he has got a private operation, but that's for the little thing. But if he would have had to hire another surgeon, bring another surgeon, all the staffing, he would have had to, mother would have had to pay for it. And I believe when we first came back, we hadn't got anybody at all. So, he did it for all, for helping. So of course, yes, my brother-in-law said, well, he says, you've been through the war. He says, if I put everything ready, exactly ready, all you have to do is follow the line, and when I tell you, you pass it on to me. That's all he wants to do. Of course, we were there a couple of days, and Sid used to come, that's my husband, he used to come in the morning and then go back to Louvain, because all this happened in Brussels. And this was particularly the day they were going to do it, it was a Sunday. And there they were going to have, it's all family. But Sid already thought he was in the family, some people, and I always said, you never gave me a chance to look at anybody else. When the moment came to do the operation, and they went down in the garden where he was sitting, he was absolutely stone drunk because of the heat, and he had been testing the wine that was homemade, and he couldn't possibly have. My brother-in-law said he would come and help. He came in the room, and as soon as he saw me, they had propped me up, but I didn't feel anything because it was all asleep to the waist, you see. He come in and he collapsed on the floor and completely. So the surgeon says, well, I can't have this. He says, I must have somebody to support. In any case, he did it and it was done beautiful. It took quite a long time before the grafting was successful, but to pump me with vitamins and goodness knows what. But of course, he had the reoccurrences all through the years. Consequently, of course, when you look at your leg, you see it's just one long scar. Well, I've got two long scars where it was on. And it was done far too early. Before, there are people that witnessed my leg, there's no doubt about it. But actually, I would have stood more of a chance if I would have kept it a bit longer.
Yes. Could we go back now? Because that's very interesting, you know, how that was coped with.
Yes.
But, you know, at the time when you were in hospital, was it all very painful? You know, when you were having to cope with this, not only the sterilisation effects, but, you know, the gangrene as well. How were you bearing up to all this pain and lack of medication?
Well, I was more or less unconscious for 3 months, off and on, and I can't remember. There are certain things which I remember. But I was about 3 months in there. I don't know. I think I'm the only one that was ever so long in there. But from that hall where that tech said she had no room, the nurse, the Belgian nurse, Claire, who was quite an important, played quite an important role in, and a French lady, and I believe she's still alive, and she was the ear, nose and throat specialist. Her husband was executed, I think, during the war. He was Belgian and she was French, or she may have been French. But in any case, she was marrying a Belgian. She would look on Belgian. She wore the Belgian insignia on her arm. And she was a doctor. And she saved my life. So. And apparently, I heard that she's still alive. But I didn't know her other name. I do know it now. It's written down in the book. Sometimes I want to get into it. She could tell you exactly what had happened there. So there's still witnesses. They took me into a corridor. And straight away, I was confronted with the matron, who was executed, all these that on that day. Oh, these were nice.